everyone, and welcome to another episode of Wisdom Chat. I'm Phil Holdsworth, your host, and my wonderful guest today is Andrew Gray. Welcome, Andrew, to Wisdom Chat.
Thank you, Phil. Hello, everybody.
Andrew, you're standing as the independent candidate in the Selby and Anstey by-election, the one where Nigel Adams stepped down recently. But equally at the same time, you built up a legal firm, Truth Legal, and then since sold it. And now you're involved with non-executive director of JAG, and also you're the founder of the Crowd Wisdom Project. There's an awful lot going on in your life at the moment, isn't there?
There's an awful lot. And I've also just bought a small language school in Spain about 6 weeks ago as well. There's a lot going on. And I also acquired some woods as well. And my kids are quite young. There's a few things going on in my life right now, Phil.
A very busy man. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on Wisdom Chat. Would you just tell our listeners a little bit about you, who you are, where you're from, and also, if you wouldn't mind, who are JAG and what's the Crowd Wisdom project?
Well, there's a lot in there. I'll be as succinct as I can. So, yes, my name's Andrew Gray. I'm from Manchester. I studied economics and politics and political philosophy at Manchester University. Wanted to become a teacher, had a go at that, but realised it was the hardest job on planet Earth. And then went to do law. But I should also say, politically, I was brought up in a very conservative, sort of quite right-wing household. So politics courses through my veins. I've delivered leaflets with my parents for the Conservative Party from quite a young age, and went to the Conservative Party conference when I was 15 or 16. And to me, the Conservatives had all the answers to our problems. And it was as simple as black and white as that. But like a complete cliche that I am, and I am a cliche, I know, is when I studied sort of politics at university, I went really left wing. That's what a lot of people do. They always say, don't they, if you're not left wing by the time you're 20, you've got no heart or something like that. But anyway, so I did do that, and working with special needs kids in a really challenging area in Salford also sort of influenced my politics. I ran a small non-NGO, non-government organisation 20 odd years ago, trying to get people to go to Burma or Myanmar ethically. That's what I used to do that. But eventually qualified as a lawyer, studied in law in New York, met my wife, first day at law school. We're still together after however many years, that is 23 years, which is quite a long time. We've got two children, live in Harrogate. Yeah, that's about me. I'm a Quaker as well. That's quite core to who I am as an individual.
Yeah, and I suppose that really informs your sort of values, your beliefs, and your approach to, I suppose, many of the issues we're facing in society today. Yes. So just tell me a little bit about JAG.
I will. Yeah. Now, so it's spelled JAAG, and it's the Just Algorithms Action Group. And actually, it was founded by Quakers. It's a non-profit campaigning organisation that has been concerned for the last 3 years about, well, AI, artificial intelligence, data, and bias within data. Their worry has always been is if you're creating systems based on data that has biases in them, it's going to be very difficult for anyone ever using those algorithms to object to it, because they won't know why something's coded. There's a famous scene in Little Britain, the computer says no. And it's a bit like that. You know, how would we know why the computer says no? Is it, are there biases against people, BME groups, older people, people of faith? You really don't know. So there needs to be like a tight mark for algorithms. And that's why I joined. It was originally Quaker created, but anyone can join it. It's not religiously affiliated.
Oh, right. Okay. And I suppose when you think about what you've just said about how can you trust the data and how the algorithms have been sort of built and so on, and the I suppose the embedding of biases in that data, it would cause people to be quite concerned about those things. is the information that's coming back the right kind of information, or is it, you know, according to one perspective? And how do we know that? I think, you know, you've hit the nail on the head with that point. That just reminded me of, you know, people perhaps having those conspiracy theories of, yes, you know, how things are being used. I suppose it can cause quite a lot of anxiety and fears and concerns about where things are going. So if I may, we'll come back to that in a moment, because there's a very good segue into what you're doing in the by-election. But in the meantime, Crowd Wisdom Project, tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, so as I said, I was in the Conservative Party as an activist growing up. Then I was in a Labour Party activist, and then I'd had some time with Liberal Democrats. In all of those parties, it's very tribal, and people are knocking lumps out of each other all the time, even though people in those parties simply want to make their countries or their local area just better. But it becomes partisan. It's like a football match being in those things. And I don't want any part of this hostility. I admire anyone who goes into those parties and stands for election, perhaps with the exception of the extreme far right, but more or less everybody else is a good egg. So during the pandemic, I was thinking about whether there ought to be like another party in the UK, like a tech party, where it responded to what people wanted. And I eventually came to the conclusion that I should form a non-profit called the Crowd Wisdom Project. And I actually set it up on my birthday as a birthday present to myself. Like, some people like cars and holidays or whatever is their fascination for you, money, I guess, and understanding that. For me, it was always politics. And I thought, well, if there's no party that fits me, you know, how do I engage in politics in a sort of entrepreneurial way? So I set up this non-profit, and I've been using this artificial intelligence system called Polis this last 2.5 years. I've used it in my own law firm. I've used it in my Quaker group. I've also used it for councils such as Wandsworth Council, Cheshire East, Chelsea and Kensington, what have you. What it does is, and I should say it's from America, this technology, and it's 10 years old, is it finds where people agree, analyzes their own sentiment anonymously, and shows everybody where everybody is on a map, and builds consensus. So it's not looking for majority, it's looking for consensus. It's intelligent, it's informative, it's addictive as well, Phil, if you ever go on one.
I've never actually seen it, but I'm interested in the fact that you stand in the by-election for Selby and Anstey as the AI candidate. So I suppose all this really links together, doesn't it?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about how that will work for the constituents of Selby and Anstey.
Okay, well, it's an unusual constituency in that it is geographically massive and takes in basically south of Harrogate, all the way over to York, down into Tadcaster, Selby, Drax, and round into Wakefield. It is huge. There isn't like one identity. People wouldn't even know that they were even in that constituency. They might say, I live in Tadcaster, but you wouldn't say, I live in Selby and Anstey. So there's lots of villages, lots of towns here, no absolute one identity. What I'm doing is I'm running a AI or Polis conversation about national political issues throughout the whole constituency to find out where people agree, what the consensus is. But I'm also doing it on a local level per each village and town. And again, the information is utterly transparent. Everybody can see where they're at. All the other candidates can use it. The media can use it. Councillors can use it. There's no downside for engaging in this process. What I'm saying to people is that my manifesto is going to come from the results. Yeah. So I don't know what it's going to be. So I have no platform other than I'm going to listen to people. If I'm elected to Parliament, which would be the biggest political earthquake possibly ever, like an independent using AI comes along at this time and wins, if it was, it would change British politics forever, because every MP would have to start listening to their constituents and doing essentially what they're told to do. And if I may, Phil, as well, as a lawyer, the lawyer-client relationship is one of the easiest relationships you could ever have. It's very simple. The lawyer has a code of ethics to look after the client. The client goes to the lawyer, you're the expert, you know, show me how you navigate the legal system. And the lawyer, you know, takes their instructions. And every time the situation changes, the lawyer says, this is the new situation. Dear client, what do you want me to do? You are the boss of it. And that's me as a representative. To me, that's how MPs should be as well, like frequently returning to the people, particularly when the world is going as fast as it is right now.
Yeah. We mentioned earlier about the fact that perhaps the whole sort of political landscape needs a bit of a shake-up, because we've had lots of things going on, from MP behaviours to decisions being made that are affecting large swathes of the population and putting people in great difficulty. And I think there were some figures just recently, let me refer to them. 93% of the population within North Yorkshire, so that part of your constituency that sits within North Yorkshire, have seen a huge rise in their cost of living. And get this, 2.5 million renters saw 45% increase in their rent since April 2022. I think there's a growing voice that says, We need a change. Something needs to change. Something needs to give us hope moving forward. And I suppose your approach is trying to tackle that change. And like you were saying, this is going to be, if you succeed, this could be the biggest shakeup in the political realm we've seen, however long. In terms of engaging with your constituents, so you're using the AI conversation to gain consensus, and then that would inform your manifesto and give you that platform. Personally, I like what you said about the fact that you're there to represent the people. I think we need to remind politicians, that's why we vote them in.
Precisely.
So I'm just thinking, how else might you be able to engage with people? You know, there are still people out there who love to talk to a real person. They love to see people face to face, and it gives them some real reassurance. Now, I know there's whole generations now coming who are quite happy to engage through social media. Tell us a little bit about how you think that's going to work for you, and also the impact that may be felt through the likes of social media as well.
Thank you, Phil. There's a lot there. If I can address your big point about interest rates and inflation and cost of living and how fast everything's going. If we go back to post-World War II, politically, everything changed then. The welfare state was created after World War II. Obviously, Churchill won the war, lost the election. But the UK fundamentally changed after that. There was a moment and it was seized, and you had the NHS was created, and you had legal aid and all of those things. The way I see things is, in the last few years, we've had COVID, Brexit, and the war in Ukraine. We've had our sort of World War II moment. Obviously, it's not been like that, and you know the deaths weren't the same, but there was an opportunity for a reset in the way that we did things, and none of the parties have taken the opportunity for that reset. So we are using old methods to solve new problems, and it's just not working at all. Inflation is out of control, in part because we printed lots of money during COVID, and that will always happen. But in part because the Bank of England's independence means it's working against the government, and there needs to be some fundamental rethink there. So I'm not seeing any parties coming up with anything big and structurally different. Hence why I had to give it a go. For me, most of our problems are systems problems, not people problems. Mm-hmm. That the people will exploit the system. So I've not been speaking about Boris Johnson and parties in my campaign. To me, he's just a symptom of our system, and he used it as best he could, and eventually, I suppose, was caught out. But that took a long time, whether you're pro-Boris or not. About a question of engagement you ask, it's a really good one. So I'm very conscious that not everybody is online. But I think my system is better than the current system. So MPs now don't really have to listen. But the people they listen to are often those who are either donors or they shout the loudest.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Growing up, I was incredibly shy. Like, I mean, it's amazing to be standing for Parliament or being a lawyer, given I wouldn't put my hand up at school. It wasn't in a play. I was utterly pathetic, and you wouldn't even know that you went to school with me. So shy people, people whose English isn't first language, also a lot of women as well. I've seen that in political parties tend to be more men. A lot of people don't want to speak up and say things to those MPs. So the current system is absolutely broken as it is. But you're right to hint at, well, not everybody's online, not everybody wants to vote, etc. And you're right. So if I was elected, I do need to work with that digital divide. But again, though, let me say, people have seen that the banks are now have closed in their area. Whatever age you are, you're having to do your banking online. You can move thousands of pounds online if you're buying a house online, but you can't vote online, you can't influence your MP online. To me, there's a massive disconnect between yeah. people's real experience of life and how our politics has been done. And I think your third point, I've lost it, is social media. Ah, yes. Well,
yeah.
Social media, Phil, is a thoroughly unpleasant place to be. You know, if you raise your head above the parapet, people are going to start taking lumps out of you, and it's horrible. I don't like being on there. I've not enjoyed it this last few weeks, but it's one of the only ways you can get your message out. We must remember that, back to algorithms, social media is just an algorithm. The cleverest people on planet Earth, these incredible psychologists and coders, have worked to try to get our eyeballs onto the social media platforms. And one of the best ways to do it is to pour petrol onto disputes to keep people there to sell more ads. It's genius, if you think about it. And the national media does exactly the same. When you use Polis, though, and I didn't create Polis, it's anonymous. And in the 2.5 years that I've been using it, and I've seen thousands of statements and 250,000 votes, I think I've seen 2 unpleasant things written in that time. It's astonishing. We are far nicer. We get on much more than the social media or the media suggests. And I want to tell everybody that. I want to be positive and optimistic.
Yeah, I suppose what you're saying there is the fact that the focus of attention is not on disagreeing. The focus of attention on is finding those things that people do agree on.
Yes.
And actually letting them know that, you know, guys, there's more that we perhaps agree on than you realise. And so we're taking a different mindset, different approach. I take your point about social media and media in general. One of the things from a psychological point of view, we as human beings need to know if something's happening. We need to know if there's a threat, where is that threat coming from?
Yes.
So that's why bad news sells so well, because we're constantly looking at what do I need to be aware of so I can react to it, I can respond to it. And yet you know that hearing good news and positive things actually is really good for our well-being and our development, whereas the negative side, all that does is stimulate the cortisol and adrenaline, which cardiovascularly has a very serious impact over an extended period of time. So if we're always constantly anxious about things, then the dangers we're creating are poor health, poor mental health, you know, which then puts a burden on the NHS, one of the services that you mentioned after the war in terms of welfare state, NHS. These were good things and people celebrated them when they were first set up. But now we're putting so much strain on them and we're not improving that strain. We're adding to it by the way that we use certain things like social media and so on. I've got to admit, I know what it feels like to be attacked on social media because I've been on the receiving end of it and it's very, very unpleasant. And we call them keyboard warriors. Because people feel that they can say whatever they want without any consideration for the impact of what they're saying or whether they care about the impact. So it is very challenging. I think more in the political circles, as you rightly say, you know, we're using old methods, old systems, outdated things to deal with modern day issues, and it's not working. And I suppose it could be the same said about the legal system. When you look at some of the laws and when they were originally created, and they were created to tackle something in their time, and we're still trying to apply them today in the modern world, and there's a disparity there. I just think, how do you feel about your approach and the kind of impact that you might have, given the fact that I think it's somewhere in the region of about 11 million people who at this moment in time don't necessarily have access to the internet for all manner of reasons. And so there's still a body of people who, as you rightly said, wouldn't be able to engage in that way. But what kind of things do you think that you might be able to do that A, shakes the system up a bit? You're being quite innovative in terms of the AI candidacy, but what other ways? Have you had any thoughts about how you might be able to do that?
There's a lot in there. Let me try and pick it if I may. Having been in lots of political parties and brought up that way with my parents, the standard way of campaigning is leaflets or knocking on doors and canvassing. And the canvassing conversation, if anyone's ever been through it, is knock on the door when usually you're doing something because they know you're in. So, you know, you're getting interrupted. Someone say, hello, I'm here from whatever the name of the party is. Can I ask you, are you going to vote at the next election? That's quite a rude question. And then the follow it up is, are you going to vote for insert name of the party at the next election? Now, in terms of sort of data, privacy, and you know, as a lawyer, I think of sort of privacy matters. The most personal information you can ever ask someone is their health matters. The second most is actually their political. So if someone's knocking on your door and asking you basically the second most impolite question that they could ask you, and we regard it as normal, it is not normal. It is incredibly intrusive, actually. And I don't really want to get involved in any of that. I'd rather people came to me, like I had ran a stall in an area and said, come and talk to me. I'm here in the library. I'd like to do all that. In this campaign, though, it's a like 3.5 week window. And I didn't know it was going to happen. I was already doing lots of other things. You have to suddenly print 50,000 leaflets, create them, follow electoral law, deal with donors, social media. There's an awful lot to do. You can't get around an area this fast. So I like the idea of halls and hustings, and online hustings. In fact, I want to engage with every religious group in Selby and Easter. So I'm trying to write to the churches to say I'm very happy to Zoom with people. In fact, in a week's time, I'll be one of the schools in York as well, talking to the children there. Notice they can't vote because I want to talk to them. I want to show them that there is another way and that we can be positive. So I want to get into children. But if though I was elected, I would have to come up with a better system than what I've got now, because it is imperfect and it is flawed. And I suppose it is actually hackable as well. So I would have to create something that's never been done before, where, you know, people in the area maybe upload their ID to prove that they live there, and we need to be able to email people, etc. But also there needs to be like iPads in village halls where people can engage and complain and etc. So I'd have to innovate and come up with something new, but I'd want to work with the people to come up with that system. And I'm sure I can be forgiven for not having all the answers to that, but all I'm saying is I am going to listen and I am going to represent, even though the listening tool is not perfect.
Just I want to pick up on that point that you just said about being forgiven for not having all the answers, and it's interesting. The politicians I've spoken to, sometimes there is a feeling that they are supposed to have all the answers, but actually none of us do. And the whole thing about engaging with the people is to take the people with you. And I think as well, it's the recognition that actually there's more power in people being together and sharing their expertise, their abilities, their knowledge, their wisdom, their experiences, to actually come up with the solutions to the problems that we're facing at the moment, rather than one individual thinking, I'm supposed to come up with some ideas. You can start the ball rolling, as you have done with your AI consensus seeking. But at the end of the day, there's a limit, isn't there? And I like what you're saying about the fact that it's important then that you talk to the people and find out what do they think. Now, some people will probably come up with some, you know, dare I say, wacky ideas. But at the end of the day, if we don't hear them, then how will we know it? And actually, somebody might come up with what they think is a wacky idea, and it could be actually a great solution moving forward.
I agree, Phil. You're absolutely right. Can I tell your listeners about one of the consensuses we found in Harrogate? So I live in Harrogate. I have a particular interest in road traffic accidents. My friend was killed on the roads years ago, and I was run over and luckily survived, and etc. When I run a police conversation on behalf of 20s Plenty here in Harrogate. Now, 20s Plenty believe that there ought to be a default speed limit of 20 miles an hour. Now, the way I run these conversations is non-party political. My own persuasions do not come in at all into how these things are run. Even though I am sympathetic to this cause, it doesn't matter. So in about 2 weeks in Harrogate, we had 14,000 votes from the people of Harrogate about the question of should there be a default speed limit. The people created hundreds of ideas, and then people were voting on these ideas, hence to get to 14,000 votes from a voters of 450 odd votes, voters. Now, the three consensus points we found were these, that irrespective of whether you are a Jeremy Clarkson type and you believe you should be able to drive as fast as you want, as noisily as you want, autobahn styly on one side, or if you're on the other side, as you believe that we should go back to an agrarian society and, you know, all cars should be, you know, recycled and never used again, wherever you were on that line, what everybody more or less agreed with is that outside schools in Harrogate, it should be 20 miles an hour outside schools. How sensible is that? And it hasn't been deployed by any of the parties. And that really annoyed me. It's still in the news now. And some children have been run over at going to school over 20 miles an hour and being seriously injured. When the people are saying, this is what we want. And that's dead easy to do. A second consensus point that we found was that people, regardless of where you were on the, you know, cars, et cetera, people like those flashing signs when they go to a village that tells them whether they're going too fast or too slow. They like that. But yet there are hardly any around Harrogate area. And I was so narked by this poor governance that I've seen. I thought, well, this is another reason why I have to have a go at this. It can be done. People have got the solutions to their own problems. There's so much wisdom, particularly at a local level.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, you know, it's heartening to hear what you've just explained to us all in terms of how you've gathered that consensus and the response. What did you say, 14,000 responses?
14,000 votes.
14,000 votes.
Votes of from 450 odd people. So people vote a number of times.
Right.
In Wandsworth recently, Phil, the people of Wandsworth came up with 600 ideas about clean air. And the average person in Wandsworth who voted 98 times on the platform. Now, I can't imagine ever having filled in any survey where you got anywhere near 98 as an average. So some people were voting on 400 ideas. Now, when you've read 400 ideas, your mind has altered. You have seen an argument from every single angle and then thought, oh, no one's thought of this idea. And then somebody writes that down and the wisdom comes out. I mean, interestingly, I run the Crowd Wisdom Project. You run the Wisdom Chat. We like wisdom. We don't profess that we have all of it or even none of it. We just know that we'd like to find it and it is there. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant. And like you, I believe... you know, people have something to say and something to contribute. And it's a great pleasure of mine talking to so many varied people from different sectors of industry and commerce and even the political system. And so that is a privilege. But I think at the same time, if we spend more time sort of listening to many people and seeing what they've got to contribute, we'd actually come up with some really remarkable ideas solving some of the, you know, like, for example, the speed limit you talk about or the air pollution. you know, solving some of these issues that we really want to deal with to make life better for us as a society. So I'm conscious that time has passed us by, Andrew, but is there anything that you'd like to say to our listeners in closing? And also, how could they get hold of you if they wanted to chat with you or engage with you in some way?
Thank you. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I knew I would. In terms of getting in touch with me, I have a website with vast amounts of information on it. It's andrew-gray.org. And I've been blogging about politics for like 10 years. So all my blogs are on there. You know, my own development as a person from right wing, left wing, liberal Democrat is all on there for everybody to see. I'm bearing all. But the final message, though, I would say to your listeners is, always try to step back from the situation that they're in and think about the system that they're in and ask themselves, is this a sensible system actually at work? Why do we do it this way? Why do we do it this way in our family? Why do we have mealtimes? Like, really, you know, almost start from a fresh piece of paper, ask themselves some profound questions, and you'll make some rapid changes to your life.
Yeah. I'm a great one for asking why. I'm always asking why. You know, people make a statement and I'll go, but why? So, and one of those right now is, why do we have to finish now? Well, we've run out of time. But Andrew, thank you so much for your valuable time. It's been great talking to you. I know we could have talked till the cows come home, but thank you very much. And I wish you all the best in the by-election. That's on the... Is it the 20th of July?
That's correct, yes.
Yes. So we sort of wait with bated breath to see how that works out. So all the very best.
Thank you, Phil.